This Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, creator and host of A Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keeler, is the guest speaker on Malik and a Home Fires radio show.
Costelic, the host for Home Fires radio show, and I knew this would happen sometime. It's my worst fear, and here it is, no guests. All of my guests have, something has happened to my guests this evening, and they have not shown up. I was planning on spending an evening talking to Catherine Peter, Eliza Jones, and Catherine Peter's daughter, Adeline Raboff, who does some work here at KUAC about traditional Native life, especially from a woman's perspective, and the kinds of changes that they've seen in their lifetime, the change from rural to urban. But I'm here by myself. So we can hope that the guests will show up soon. We had a letter. It was a letter, Carla? Yes? A letter. This week from a listener who said that they would like me to tell you in advance who my guests will be and what topics we'll be covering, so the ones of special interest could be tuned into. For the next 3 weeks, I hopefully have the following schedule. Next week, we're going to talk about gardening. I spent some time today digging up some dirt and raking some leaves, and it's very exciting. The whole town's turned green in the last 72 hours. I'm excited anyway. Got some dirt under my nails for the first time in way more months than I like it to be before I can garden. So we're going to talk about gardening, and we're going to have some experts in the studio with us, and so you can ask lots of questions as we prepare to plant at the beginning of June. Then the following week, I'm going to have, as my guests, Mary and Jim Binkley, and we're going to talk about their 30-some years running the sternwheeler up and down the river. And the following week, there are some definite and fairly interesting changes in Solstice this year. And Wyndham Hill is coming to do a concert, which is very exciting. I don't know how many of you heard the interview that Robert Gilfillan did with Pat talking about some of the things that are going to be included in this year's Solstice, but it sounds very exciting. And Pat has also promised to bring in the studio. That'll be on the 2nd of June, I believe. I don't have a calendar in front of me. Some people who have been involved with Solstice way in the distant past when it was first started as a sort of community celebration. And so we'll reminisce about some of the old times and places that Solstice was held and what constituted some of the celebrations in times past. So that's the lineup, I hope. Since I have this time here before I panic and go to music, I would really like some of you to call 474-5044 and give me your suggestions for topics in the future or for people that you'd like to hear from, and use this open time to make some comments on programs of the past that you particularly like, subject matter that you'd like a little more follow-up or additional programming on, just a general have your comments. My number is 474-5044. So I would really welcome your calling. Then the other thing I suppose we could do if we run out of music is Catherine Peter has written a book about her experiences during the early years of her marriage. She lived in Chandelier country, spent a lot of time around the area of Arctic Village. That's Pauline Carlo. I'm right. Catherine Peter was in Arctic Village, which is far north, and they did a lot of subsistence hunting in around the Brooks Range. And so I might read a little later from her book, and hopefully my guests will show up, and hopefully some of you will call 474-5044. This is This sounds like the fundraising thing again. You just keep repeating the number 4745044. I know that all of you are really out in your gardens.
Patty, we did have a caller on the other phone line. They didn't want to call in on the air, but they asked that you talk about yourself, who you are, and public radio.
What about myself? A little biographical material. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta. Both my grandparents, are you sure they want this? This has got to be very tough.
I'm just passing the message along, Patty.
All right, if you would like me to stop, I will continue. But if you would like me to stop, you can call 474-5044. If this gets too tedious and boring, anyone who wants to vote for Windham Hill, just call 474-5044. I'm very lonely here. Okay, I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, and both sets of grandparents, one set was a Norwegian grandmother and a Swedish grandfather, and the other grandparents were from Yugoslavia, all immigrated to the United States in the in 1908, 1909, 1910. The Scandinavian relatives went to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which is, of course, a very common destination, and my grandmother worked in as a housekeeper, and my grandfather in some sawmills. He did some lumberjacking in the south, and they heard that there was homesteadable land in Canada. And my other grandfather was a copper miner in Butte, and when my father was born, that was their first child of nine. My grandmother said, if we don't get out of this mining town where everybody dies in their 20s, I'm leaving you. And so they went up to Alberta and homesteaded too. So all my relatives are up there, and they all are farmers. My father, for some reason, decided that the farm was too crowded with four brothers, and after doing a little railroad bumming and some lumberjacking in Port Alberni, which is on Vancouver Island, he decided it was probably better to go back to school, which he did, and he became a biochemist. And so I spent my growing up years in the Midwest at all Midwestern universities, Wisconsin, where he got his degree, then Ames, Iowa, and then Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. So I'm a real Midwestern girl, and I had a very Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm upbringing. Fell out of tree, scraped my knee, learned to ride a bike, so on and so forth. Just really not fascinating stuff. My number is 4745044, so you could stop this at any time. Anyway, then when I... see, someone can't stand it. Save me. Carly is not going to give me the signal too quickly. Okay. Hello, you're on the air?
The man had called before, and I'm very glad. Let me turn the radio down here. I'm very glad I did, because now instead of just being a voice that comes to us, you're real. I'm from Wisconsin. I've been to Ames, Iowa, and you know about your grandparents, and I think that's neat, and that's one of the things I think kids should find out more about.
I actually really agree.
Hello?
I think personal histories are very important. And
hello?
Hello?
Did you disappear?
No.
What?
No.
Oh. All right, and I just mean it. One of the things I worked in Barrow for 2 years as a teacher,
uh-huh.
And they had a program on I believe it was Sunday night, in which the elders of the village, the men, sat around and told stories about their youth and about hunting and stuff. And it was one of the most fascinating programs in the world,
mm-hmm.
And got a great deal of laughter, and you could identify with them and the hardship, and you developed a sense of appreciation from knowing them better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what you did was just great.
Thanks.
And I think that probably that, in my opinion, my field was communication, and I got my master's at SC a long, long time ago. I think probably if you go back to Arthur Godfrey and the great Dave Garroway and stuff like that, if there's one thing that's missing today, that is the personal quality. There used to be. Now it's entirely too impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, very plastic. No, I agree with you, and that's a wonderful thing about the radio. I listened to the radio a lot when I was growing up. It was a real important part of my household. And that personal quality that a lot of the radio personalities had back in the 40s and 50s is really nice. And I like that. You got to know them and when they had additions to their family and when there were problems, and it made you feel like you had a friend. I agree.
And when Arthur Godfrey's voice broke when they were burying Franklin Roosevelt and Orson Welles. And the thing about radio, too, that was so wonderful that I rediscovered, actually, in Barrow, although I've always loved it and listened to it, was the fact it makes you form pictures in your mind. You don't just sit there. You go one dimension further.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a lot, you have a dimension that nothing but radio can give to you. So it's fun. I'm glad you did it.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Thank you. You want to tell us something about your... Oh, you've told us, actually, a lot about yourself. You grew up in Wisconsin?
I grew up in Wisconsin, and I was a typical street kid, and then came the time to go to college, and I rambled around the country. In those days, you used to try out as an athlete to see if you could get a scholarship, and I finally decided I wanted to settle down in a small little town, so I went to a very small state teacher's college and was very happy doing what I did to become a teacher, and went away and taught in small towns, and then at 51 decided to go to the coast and get my master's in communication because I figured that was the answer to most of the problems and the basic answer to teaching. And I personally think it's the answer to the problems of the world, that people would just stop and listen to each other and realize that they're not different at all, that they feel the same and they have the same feelings and the same caring and that their values aren't that totally different.
Mm-hmm. When did you come to Alaska?
77. I was working in Las Vegas, and I had been a dean of a college and a college football coach and all that sort of thing, and then I decided I had enough of it after going through the Vietnam protests as dean of a fairly large college, and so I went off to Vegas to become a crap dealer.
You found that a major switch in careers, or you actually found it had something in common with the other one?
It spilled people, so I was reading in the paper on my break, and lo and behold, there was an interview at the Sands Hotel for a firm from Barrow.
Uh-huh.
I was a representative there, and I went. All I knew was that Wiley Post and Lindbergh had crashed there, because that was the first extra newspaper I sold. And so I thought, well, I had worked in the ghetto, and I'd taught farm kids and Indians, but I'd never, all I used to do was dream about and read about Eskimos, so I jumped at the chance to go.
So you enjoyed your time in Barrow?
I loved it. I loved the people. I'm a night person, so the nighttime didn't bother me. The weather didn't bother me. I thought it was a great experience.
Yeah, that was interesting. Catherine Peter's book, Living in the Chandelier Country, there were a couple of... I read it this morning and had a very pleasant time sitting in the sunshine and reading it. And one of the things that was interesting to me is that she never once mentioned being cold through the entire book. She talks about hunting and fishing and so on, and they were up in the Brooks Range, and this was back in the 30s. She never mentions being cold, and she never talks about bears. And I was sort of stunned by those two omissions. But
it's much, much different. It's I think the coldest place in the world is Michigan Boulevard in Chicago at about 15 below with the wind coming off of the lake. That's why they call it the Hawk.
I would agree with you. It is really incredible. And we were back home for a visit a couple of Christmases ago, and Sam was just incredulous. He said it's like driving across pressure ridges in the Bering Sea and the wind howling. He says he's never seen worse weather than we had when we were back in Illinois for that Christmas. It can be really vicious. The other place that I think is vicious is Winnipeg.
Oh, yeah.
I remember once going from my grandparents' house on the train. This must have been in the 50s, back to Illinois. We had 8 hours stopover in Winnipeg, and we decide, well, we go from the train station downtown to do some shopping. I have never been colder in my life. It was unbelievable.
In Barrow, I wore a green London Fog raincoat and with a lining, of course, and my Eskimo name, they called me Iqaluk. I can't remember how to say it in Inupiat, though, but Iqaluk, the man in Iqaluk, and then it would be the man in the crazy man in the green raincoat.
Well, I think you sound like you're fairly hardy, because I don't think I'd spend a winter in Barrow in a London Fog raincoat.
You'd be surprised. Actually, you would. The lady up there was on the Johnny Carson show, Fran Tate. That's what stunned most of the people when she said that you're really not that cold. It's a dry cold.
Uh-huh.
It truly is a dry cold. But, of course, when the wind comes and it drives it, you know, drives it through you, it's cold. But
mm-hmm.
it's not that bad. Anyway, you got a great show, and I never miss it if it's at all possible to hear.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night. Well, that was a very pleasant conversation, and I could have a few more callers, and we could get through this hour. Our number is 474-5044. This is your chance to help me out on this program without having to make a trip to the station. You can do your volunteer service for KUAC this evening by dialing your phone, 474-5044, and talking about something that's interesting to you or a hobby that you have or something that you'd like to talk to Fairbanks about. Feel like Stephen King. Here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I just have two suggestions for future programs, if that's appropriate.
It is very appropriate.
Two people I would love to hear on your radio show are, number one, Rich Seifert.
Yes.
Who's with the Cooperative Extension.
He has been on my show, but he is so knowledgeable about so many things, he often crosses my mind, and I'd love to have him back.
Great, I'd love to have him on there. And there's one more person I'd really like to have on your show, and that's Dick Randolph.
Oh, yes.
Since he's not in office, you can't say it's a political thing. And most of the libertarians' ideas, I don't think, really are as political as they are
lifestyle, idealistic.
Right.
And he's an excellent conversationalist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he seems to know what he's talking about, and I love to hear the new ideas that those libertarians are coming up with all the time. Some of them are kind of wacko, but most of them seem to strike home as being very sensible.
Well, they're certainly thought-provoking, and I think actually a very viable Libertarian Party makes the whole political process in Alaska a little bit more lively. I think they're a very beneficial addition. I met someone from Hawaii this week, and they were saying that basically it's a one-party system there, only because there are only 5 representatives in the entire state legislature from the Republican Party. The rest is all Democrat, and they say it's very dull. Now, I wouldn't ever describe Alaskan politics as dull.
Yeah, it's nice to have that foil, I guess you'd call it, for the ideas of the two major parties. Some of them call them Demo-publicans or whatever, because they seem to be so alike at all times, tax and spend and whatnot. Well, that's my only suggestion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I am definitely going to have Rich back soon. He is just knowledgeable about a lot of things. They had a huge energy conference up at the university here a few weeks or a couple of months ago, and I wanted to have Rich up after that to talk about what had come of that conference and what kind of ideas he wanted to share with us, so I will pursue that.
Well, that's the hardest thing to do, is to get the ideas for a new technique of construction that's not only very efficient but inexpensive. Some of the greatest ideas use the cheapest materials you could think of.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard some of the programs we've done on building. I think Alaska is an excellent, I was stunned when I first came here to see the kind of bizarre building structures in such a harsh climate. But in fact, I think it's some of this non-conforming money, the fact that it is hard to get bank loans, has really inspired people to be very creative. And this sort of board of the week plan has, I think, really been beneficial in some respects. There's been some very interesting building and interesting ideas that have come up for energy conservation and so on. So in some ways, it's been real profitable for us to have some constraints on the way we can finance our homes.
I have another question I'll throw at you. Maybe one of your callers can answer it. It has nothing to do with anything I've spoken of previous, and that is, I want to transplant some small birch saplings in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
If I go out on some of these tailing piles or in the woods and I find some little 2 to 4 foot birch saplings, how do I have to dig them up and treat them to make sure that they'll survive when I transplant them?
Well, I am not the expert, but in fact we did that, and this is the second year, and they've all leafed out very nicely. We dug them up in the fall, and you'll find that because they were free, we wanted big ones, so we went for the 10 and 12 foot ones and used a lot of muscle getting them into the wheelbarrow. If you cut a base of about 3 feet across, you'll find that most of the roots are in the top 6 inches of soil and spread out, of course, very, very far. But you can, without too much damage, cut at a circumference of about 3 feet, have a hole prepared 3 feet across, I'm saying, and about 6 inches deep. We just put them into the wheelbarrow and carted them across and had a hole prepared. And we put some bone meal in. And I don't remember if anything much more than that. Later on, we used dilute fertilizer. You set the tree in. You try not... There's a very critical place in the birch tree, which is a crown right underneath the trunk. And you must not rock that or move it so that it breaks. So you have to keep that crown flat. But that's, I understand, the most critical part. You put it in the hole that you have prepared and water very, very well so that those roots can settle down into the dirt and tamp around with your feet to make sure that there aren't air pockets. Roots hate air pockets when they're trying to settle in, and they need moisture so that new soil settles around and doesn't break the roots. But we only lost two, and I think we moved 15 or 18. They transplanted very, very well. I mean, an advantage here is that their roots are so shallow that you don't have to worry about deep tap roots.
Is it inappropriate to do that at this time of year?
Yes, it is. In Alaska, plants just get desperate. Even if the ground's frozen, they've decided they're going to let the sap run and the leaves come out. It's just amazing to me. The best time, the best success for you would be sometime in the late summer when they're starting to go into their dormant period, and then they have a winter to sort of rest, and then they get a real good fast start in the spring. So we transplanted in late August, early September, before the ground's frozen, and enough to let them get settled in before we start getting real hard freezes. And I think that's my recommendation, although if someone has superior wisdom out there, please, I am not the authority. But this did work for us. So we also moved some spruce that way, and it's very nice. We had a yard which had the sort of standard Alaskan landscaping method, which is sort of just D9 this big rectangle out in front of the house, and it just looked very stark to us. So we've got a nice sparse woods out there, just through our own efforts. It's a little bit of muscle and sweat, but it worked well.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your advice.
Well, you're welcome.
Good night.
Good night. Well, all my callers are very interesting here. If we have anyone else who has something they'd like to talk about, it's 474-5044. It's going to be much more interesting than if I do a monologue. I'm better at asking questions than I am just... Well, actually, some of my friends would argue I talk a lot. That's true. 474-5044. Surely you have something else to say.
Patty, we did have another call earlier, somebody who didn't want to talk on the air who wants you to keep talking about yourself.
Okay.
They want more autobiographical material.
More autobiographical.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how you got to be where you are right this minute.
A circuitous route, I assure you. We have another caller about to save me from this continuing biography here. Just a second. Before I launch into my New York years here, we'll take this call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. In addition to the fine information you gave on planting the trees, I find birch trees just readily any time of year will just take off and grow.
Okay, good.
But a tree should, any kind of tree, should never be planted deeper than it's growing when you take it up.
That's right.
An inch, because it has a different kind of bark under the
soil.
Ground, under the soil as it has on top.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, general rule of thumb is the main roots are as far out as the branches, the farthest branches of the tree.
Okay.
If your root ball is as big as in circumference as the outside branches, then you're safe. You didn't cut any major roots.
Great. Good.
I transplanted both birch and spruce trees and had them do well. I think the birch trees take and grow much easier than the spruce do.
Mm-hmm. Although we did have good luck with our spruce as well. One has just got a tremendous number of cones.
You sound like you've got bigger trees and a lot more, a lot bigger root ball than the ones I wasn't that ambitious. I only had about 18-inch trees.
I had someone real strong to help me, and I don't know why we decided to go for such big ones, but it worked out fine.
Because you wanted immediate landscape.
Right, we wanted instant forest. That's almost what we got. I think it would probably be better to start slightly smaller, although they have done very well. But that is good, because, in fact, that is what we did. It's just if you chose a smaller tree, then you could use a smaller root ball. And we really tried to not disturb the dirt that was around those mm-hmm. roots. We try and get your root ball, get a gunny sack or some heavy visqueen out there and sort of ease the tree onto the plastic and try and keep it pretty much intact so that when we put them in the new holes, which were the same shape and size, the grass just that was around those trees just kept growing.
Yes, I had the same thing. The trees, that too is a good point, not to lift it up by its trunk anyway. Mm-hmm. And slide it over and slide it back in, because once you pull up on the trunk, you're putting
pressure
on the roots,
mm-hmm.
And it's not a good... But many people transplanting trees, this goes for a lot of any single trunk, I think, and they'll mound around it, whereas a mistake, because if you put an inch or two of dirt higher than it was growing, then you kill the tree, usually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't put any extra dirt around the trunk itself at all, because we had that root ball that came with it. We had
mm-hmm.
to fill in a little around the edges,
around it, right.
You know, but that works out very well. And yes, you're quite right. Don't put any dirt up around the base of the trunk. They don't like
this,
that.
This was learned by whoever was doing the landscaping at Elmendorf and Anchorage there, the entrance to the base.
Mm-hmm.
The third time they planted trees, somebody finally must have informed them. They'd mound up around it, and they killed all their trees.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, sometimes it's good to have a kind of little...
A depression
so that you can get them started by having them hold water.
Yes.
So when you water them, and what's real important for people... I've seen people very often there, whether you buy trees or dig them up in the woods to transplant, they're very serious about them for the first couple of weeks. They water them very
mm-hmm.
well when they first put them in, and then may think of them the next week, and after a while they think they're part of the landscape. But in fact, trees and bushes take about a year to...
At least a season
to establish themselves. So treat them like the rest of your garden for that first year, even though they're indigenous plants. Make sure that you give them water during dry periods. And they like
the preparation, too, that it has B1 in it, I know, for a shock treatment for transplanting shrubs and trees that I used on the ones I planted. It has some vitamins, and it's called shock treatment for planting in the nurseries and garden stores.
Uh-huh.
He has it.
Yeah, there are several commercial things, something called Transplantone, but they have a variety of things in it which helps young plants make roots make the transition when they are moved, and they do go through a sort of shocky phase for a little while, so you just have to watch them. But I'm glad for our other listener that he can do it now.
Yes.
I would have hated him to wait a whole season.
I did mine in spring.
Oh, good. Okay.
It worked.
Well, there you go. Tomorrow looks like another good gardening day, and so you can get out and do that, because you can't, of course, really, they tell us we can't start our gardens yet, and it's just, this is a very difficult time for me, because I'm just, especially the soil feels pretty warm. We've had visqueen on it, and it's sunny and hot, and you just want to put the seeds in, and you want to start. You can put a little lettuce seeds in and so on, but those tender little plants, unless we're very lucky this year, they really can't be put in for another few days here. They say June 1st is the safe time, and even people in nurseries who run nurseries will tell you June 1st. Of course, they make a lot of profit if everyone jumps the gun, buys a lot of plants, puts them in, and then they all freeze. Then we all have to go back and buy more.
Some of the old-timers who have done it for years have a better feel that, you know, they feel things, but then that's probably safest.
What do you feel this year?
No, I'm not that much of an old-timer.
No?
I've been here over 30 years, but I'm not that much of a gardener, I'll put it that way.
Okay. Well, I put in some, I started some sweet peas, and I couldn't help it. They can take a little frost.
Yeah,
but
sweet
they were
peas
just...
are, and lettuce, as you said, are cool. They're cool weather.
Mm-hmm. If you get a jump on some, well, just, and it also depends on the location of your garden, because,
right,
of course, if the soil temperature is too cool, it doesn't matter what the air feels like.
Right.
The seeds will just sit there and rot.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've had your soil turned over and had some plastic on it, it may be okay to put some lettuce and some radishes in. Now, actually, radishes like cool. And they do well, and they don't need real hot soil. But of course, all the flowers and some of the other more delicate things really.
I found out petunias are pretty tough.
Really, I haven't. I'm not a petunia fan myself, so I don't. I don't do those.
I transplanted some several days ago, and it got so cool in the night, and I thought, oh, there goes my petunias. But here they are.
Uh huh. Oh, good. Yeah, some things are amazingly hot. Frost resistant. They can even freeze a little bit and continue to grow and bloom. Peas are like that. In the fall, you can have them out there and you wake up in the morning and they're all frozen and they thaw out by mid-morning and start putting on some more blossoms. Mm-hmm. Of course, you aren't going to get
any more peas.
Yeah, right, any more peas, but it's sort of nice and comforting to see
them.
That's right. Well, this is, for anyone who gardens in Alaska, this is very exciting time of year. We're just full of anticipation, ready to put our shovels in the soil.
Well, when I came to Alaska, I came from the deep south where everything is, you know, take it easy, everything's so laid back, and the suddenness of the seasons here thrilled me no end. It still does after 32 years.
It is.
Like you said, everything got green, and it was actually less than 72 hours if you were really looking out when I'm surrounded by trees here, and I realized after that shower, one rain shower, and
yep,
then 3 hours later, I saw the green when the sun went low.
It's really fast, and also, I never get over the shock of how quick the fall also is.
Spring comes just as quickly if you really attuned to it, though.
No, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know. I think it was just 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, that we had some snow in the air.
Yes.
I said, this feels like an October day here.
Mm-hmm.
It had all that kind of crisp, desolate feeling of late fall, well, October here.
The wind was blowing from the north, even.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And here we are in...
One never knows.
Yes, that's it. Well, we had an Oklahoma friend. I lived for a while in Oklahoma. If I get back to my biography, you'll hear about my Oklahoma years. But we had a sort of gardening guru named Tony Deppel, who had been gardening in Oklahoma for 50 years. He was in his 70s. He'd started truck farming with his father back in the 20s, I believe. And he said he would tell us, because we were Yankees, he'd say, only damn fools and Yankees worry about the weather. And I don't know that was an original statement with him, but he used it on us a lot, because we would be wringing our hands, worrying about hail, worrying about freezes, worrying about heat, and so on. And he was much more philosophical. And I guess as I get older, I may get that way too. But right now,
when you reach 70, I suppose you will.
That's right. That's right.
Things change a lot if you reach that age.
You've seen enough seasons by then. You know that there's nothing you can do about it. My first summer here, there was we live by the river out by the airport, and there is kind of a depression there. And there was a real hard freeze, only for a few hours, but a real hard freeze on August 16th. And I thought probably they could hear my screams on Chena Ridge. I was so dismayed. All the dahlias that were just about to pop and so on, which they just cannot stand any kind of freeze at all. They were just looking sorrowful. So anyway, but there is nothing we can do about it. And I'm hoping for a bright, sunny summer here. And we certainly have the light now. And we're starting out very well after a late start. I think it probably isn't late. It's probably right on time. It's just that it was so nice at the end of March. We all got our hopes up that it would be unusual this year.
That's the mistake we all make. I always think when it's so nice so early, we're going to get it when it should be nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, it's just, and the winters here, I believe it's true. I'm getting used to the cold now, and if you dress adequately and the way we live our lives, it's really not so bad. It's just that winters seem very long to me here. And I think maybe in the final analysis, that's my main objection, is just the length.
Imagine what the winters seem like to me coming from the deep south. When I came up here.
You came straight from the deep south?
I came in the middle of summer, however, but I did come from the deep south to Alaska.
Was it hard for you to adjust to the winters?
Not really, because it's very humid. Humidity runs in the hundreds of percentages down in southern Louisiana, and up here it was dry, and you don't feel the cold as much. And as you say, if you dress adequately, if you wear it too warm, you can take off. You can't take off enough things to cool off. Mm-hmm. It's too hot. But you can always add a layer that helps you when it's cold.
That's true. My sister lives in New Orleans, and it's just amazing there. You take a shower, you walk out, and you are just dripping wet. You can't breathe. Of course, they have some architecture that takes into account. They have very tall ceilings and big, thick walls, but still, you're right. There's nothing you can do.
You have houses sitting several feet off the ground in most places.
Uh-huh.
And something else, too, the barometric pressure there in New Orleans. New Orleans is something like 17 feet below sea level.
Mm-hmm.
I know. That's where I came to Fairbanks from New Orleans.
Is that right?
Yeah, I know. I go back now, and I swear everything I touch is wet.
Uh-huh.
Clothes off the line, it's 93 degrees outdoors, and taking clothes off the line and my sister's, and I swear as soon as they cool down to the temperature inside the house, I swear everything was damp.
I know.
We took them off the line dry, but it's wet.
It's real moldy. That's right.
Well, if you stand still too long down there, you'll mildew.
It's true. It's true. That is a real problem for them, and all kinds of things with clothes that they're trying to store and so on. And Fairbanks is really the opposite. What brought you here?
I came up on a contract for the BIA.
Uh-huh. And you moved first to Fairbanks, or you were...
No, I just came through Fairbanks to go to the Yukon.
Uh-huh. Where were you on the Yukon?
Tanana.
Uh-huh.
I worked at Tanana.
And how long were you out there?
Oh, I only worked for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But then I married Alaska, and I'm still here.
Yeah, I know. I know the feeling. There's some of them that you can't get out of the state, even with dynamite. So once you've gotten involved with them, then you're here too.
There's no warm area. You either love it or you hate it.
I think that may be true.
I don't think anyone is lukewarm about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the immensity of the place, the newness, everything. Like, you mentioned politics a while ago, that politics here is not dull. Well, this was something else that was... Everything is so new.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was here before statehood, and seeing it all in its... Even before infancy, in its embryonic stage,
uh-huh.
it was just all so exciting to me. It still is.
Mm-hmm. It's really an amazing state for opportunities. I must say that I feel that Alaska's been very good to me. If you've got some energy and are willing to make some efforts, people are very welcoming of you and really give you opportunity to use your talents in every way that you want to put effort forth, and that's not true other places. And so I think that's one thing that continues to be true of Alaska. I mean, obviously it's changed drastically in 30 years, but opportunity is still very much here. So, well, thank you very much for calling. It's been very interesting talking to you. You have anything else to say?
No, that's someone else may want to talk to you now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Great, thanks. Oh, it was a very pleasant conversation. I always love, you can tell, I love to talk about gardening. I talk about gardening all day long. My number is 474-5044. If you want to save yourself from a little more of this biography, just call 474-5044. I'm sure we could find something more interesting to talk about than me. Do you want to put on a record, or should I continue with this biography? I'll continue a little bit. I went to New York in 1972. My parents were going to Africa to help start a university in Africa, Njala College in Sierra Leone, and I thought that was a good time for me to leave the Midwest. Most people growing up in the 50s in the Midwest wanted to be on one of the coasts because that seemed where it was happening. Maybe that's always true about growing up in the Midwest. Actually, F. Scott Fitzgerald, there are a number of people that expressed that view, just not just myself. So anyway, I went to New York City, and I had worked when I was going to college at the University of Illinois for someone who was getting a degree in comparative psych, and he helped me get a job at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the pathology department. And there I learned electron microscopy, and I became for 10 years an electron microscopist in New York City. And it was the 60s, and I was in my 20s, and I had a wonderful time. I thought that was just exactly where I should have been. I spent, of that 10 years, I didn't actually spend all of that time in the city. I developed this habit of going back and forth to Europe a little bit. That was the days of Icelandic Airways, when you could get back and forth from New York to Central Europe for... Now, this is the figure that sticks out in my mind, $166. Now, that seems amazing to me. I'm not all that old, but that figure is so clear in my mind. If somebody else was in New York in the 60s and has a different figure for Icelandic Airways return, call me up at 474-5044 and tell me. But anyway, so I worked, in fact, for a year in Paris and spent a couple of years hitchhiking around, went to Africa to see my parents, and that was a really fascinating experience. We went on a lot of treks out into the bush along with my father on his work, and I very much liked my time in Sierra Leone. I was there for 7 months. Very interesting culture, very warm and hospitable people, and the point of Njala was that they were having a lot of trouble with their young, very bright students going to England or going to France. At that time, Sierra Leone was a British protectorate, a British possession, and so that was before independence, just shortly before independence. And so a lot of students went to England and then didn't want to return to Sierra Leone or found it difficult to translate the skills that they'd learned in England and the kind of emphasis that they'd learned those skills with in England back to Sierra Leone. So this was an attempt to teach the students some very practical skills and to keep them in the country. So it was just a very interesting experience. I toured the Middle East before the 67 war, was in Lebanon, which... It is constantly amazing to me listening to the news reports in the last 2-3 years, because when I was in Lebanon, it was a jewel. They talk about Hungary as during the first part of the century as being a kind of jewel basket and a jewel area, the breadbasket of Eastern Europe, and it's very different. Budapest is very different since the uprising in 56. And Lebanon must be the same, because when I was there, it was the most cosmopolitan European influenced city there was, and just really incredible restaurants and very fancy stores, and just the American University there. It was just a very special city, and it really makes me sad to hear these reports of what it is now. At any rate, we went from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and came through at Christmas time through the Mandelbaum gates, and spent 6 months in Israel working on kibbutzim, and traveled around Europe. I've been in most of Europe for some extended visiting, traveling. The only place I haven't been, oddly enough, since I have Scandinavian relatives of the Scandinavian countries, at the time I just thought they would be too expensive for our rather minimal budget. We were at that time living, I think, on $3 a day each, and that was, I thought, quite good lifestyle in Europe at that time. So I know anyone who's been recently knows how inflated it's become. We worked for a while one summer when there were a lot of tourists around and cheaper hotels were hard to find. And just if you're there in the winter, it seemed too touristy in the summer. Oh, and I think probably we were just also tired of traveling. So I worked for the Officers Club, the American Officers Club in Berlin for 3 months. I was the chief payroll clerk, which I knew absolutely nothing about. When I got that job, I had to do the liquor inventory and the petty cash and so on. And that was actually a fun experience. My husband was a soda jerk at the snack bar at the airport. So that I found Berlin also very interesting. There's this very special attitude in Berlin. I assume it's the same. It certainly was different than any place else in Germany in the 60s. And I had a Hungarian friend who was the director of the Berliner Ensemble, the Brecht Ensemble in East Germany, in East Berlin. And we used to travel across there and quite frequently to see Brecht performed. And so that was a kind of high point. Later on, a few years later, I came back and I worked for a year in Paris at Hôpital Saint-Louis doing electron microscopy. And Paris is a very beautiful city, but I decided that the life of an expatriate was not for me, so I came back to New York after a very pleasant year. I don't think that the French and myself are exactly the best cultural match. I was much happier in the Mediterranean countries, eating salads and dancing under the stars. But at any rate, I came back to New York, and after about 10 years, I had decided that just having to do your laundry at 3 o'clock in the morning, because that's the only time you could depend on there being a dryer for your wet washing, and you had to stay with your laundry at all times, because people would actually steal your wet towels. It was unbelievable. And walking, living in a fifth-floor walk-up, which was great for the calf muscles and was the best way that you could cheaply have some sunshine in your apartment, because if you were on the bottom, then you were probably looking out in an air shaft. All these things, there's a play, Six Rooms Riv View, that have to do with accommodations, finding an apartment in New York, which I understand has gotten even worse. But anyway, I decided that I'd had enough of New York, and ended up through an odd set of one step forward, two steps back, in living in a little town called Edmond, Oklahoma. And there, with my sister and husband, had a sunglass business. We had a wholesale retail sunglass business. We worked flea markets all over the Southwest, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, Louisiana. It was sort of have business, we'll travel. When we had a friend we wanted to go see, or when we had a part of the country we wanted to go visit, we just put our business in the back of the truck and go. And I got to see a lot of the Southwest that way, and I liked it very much. I loved the climate. I thought Oklahoma had the most perfect climate that I'd ever lived in. Carla is looking at me aghast, and I know a lot of people feel that way, but I think it's sort of a well-kept secret. We had roses from early April until Thanksgiving, with our rose bushes just sort of taking a couple of months off in July and August to be dormant. But the rest of the time, we were actively gardening, and I got used to the varieties of plants. I got very much into the Iris Society there, and I made friends with all these wonderful 80 and 90-year-old women who kept threatening that they were too old to dig, but they kept digging, and you get these wonderful catalogs with 100 or 200 varieties of the most exotic irises, and the descriptions of the plants sound like haiku. They describe their throats and their petals and so on. So I got very much into iris growing, and we, in fact, collected some blue ribbons for our irises, and that was a very sad thing to leave them and have to give them up. But I like the northern colors as well. Is no one going to bail me out of this here? 4745044. Anyway, we also sold sunglasses to small drugstores and sort of mom and pop operations. There are lots of small towns in Oklahoma. It's quite a rural state, and has a lot of little stores that are still owned by families that have owned them for a number of years. And so we would, we gave a lot of, we were a high service organization and gave a lot of service to our clients. And I very much liked having my own business. Unfortunately, sunglasses did not translate easily to Alaska. And when I met Sam and moved to Alaska, to Fairbanks in 1980, I was without a business and without an occupation. And so I just took my time getting involved with the community. I worked for a little while at Northern Lights, transplanting and dragging 1,000 feet of hose around. And then did some political work on a couple of campaigns and eventually ended up applying for and very happily for me getting the job of a newly created tiny department at the university called the Women's Center, which still just consists of me and a lot of volunteers and a lot of help from a lot of other people. And my experience for my present job is that I've always been involved with the women's movement since my early 20s in the 60s in New York, and did a lot of extracurricular spare time volunteer activities having to do with the women's movement. Worked on a project in New York of developing 3 storefront women's health delivery centers. We call them women's centers, and they were little storefront operations where I felt a lot of women weren't getting good information with their medical care. They were probably getting very good, in some cases, state-of-the-art medical care, but in big city hospitals, there's very little time for patient-doctor contact and very little time for good information, and sometimes that's as important as the pills or the technical treatment that you get, understanding that you must be involved with your own medical care, and especially for women before pregnancy, after pregnancy, so on and so forth. So I was very involved with that in New York and spent a lot of time on that and some other political activities. And so now I'm doing the Women's Center here in Fairbanks and do this program, this radio program, voluntarily, and I don't even know how I got roped in on this. I was around, and someone didn't show up for a program, I guess much like tonight, and so we did a garden program, and one thing led to another, and now I'm here on a weekly basis, bending your ear. We are almost out of time, thankfully. If there are any reactions to this wonderful life saga I've just told you, 474-5044, please call in. If there are any more audience suggestions about the kind of programs that you'd like to hear, I really would like to hear from you. Most of these ideas come out of my head. Luckily, Fairbanks has been very gracious in helping me put on these programs. I have found it increasingly, it's been increasingly easy to get guests on now that more people know about the Home Fires Radio Show and have sort of understand the concept. Most of my guests have told me that it was a lot easier being on the show than they anticipated. I think because I really do want to preserve a very conversational tone. I really do strongly believe that conversation is very important, and there has been some fear at some points that conversation is a dying art. I certainly hope that's not true. I think maybe less in Fairbanks than it is some other places. I'm not a fan of TV, and although I acknowledge that there are some very good things on it, I think, to quote my first caller, that it doesn't require imagination, and very often you don't even know what you saw at the next morning. So I'm a big fan of radio, and conversation is one of the things that's very well suited to radio. I have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, hello, Patty. This is Celia Hunter.
Hello, Celia.
Just wanted to tell you that you've been doing very well, and I thoroughly enjoyed your life saga. After all, it's a little bit reminiscent of what Jenny Wood and I did during the 40s, late 1947-48, batting around Europe. So we were in a lot of the, we didn't get down into the Mediterranean at that point, particularly outside of Italy, because it wasn't very practical, but we did spend quite a bit of time in Scandinavia, and at that time it wasn't all that expensive. But I just thought I would let you know that you are being listened to, and I agree with you about radio. I think radio is, I find I do a lot more listening to radio than I ever watch television.
Mm-hmm.
You can listen to radio and do a lot of things.
That's right. You can listen to radio,
television, and do anything else.
Right, right. It's set up that way. You can listen to radio and garden. You can listen to radio and do any number of handcrafts, wash dishes, just a whole variety of things. So it's not so disruptive of your chores and duties. How was it? Must have been wonderful to be in the Mediterranean in the 40s. That when I was there, I thought, oh, if I'd only been here 20 years earlier.
That's when Corbusier was in Greece, and when all those wonderful artists, the great early modern artists, were all in the south of France at that time. They all moved down in the 40s and 50s to the Provence area. Did you get across there?
Oh, yes, but I'm afraid at that point I wasn't really into art very much, so we probably overlooked many, many opportunities.
Well, there's so much. The thing that really impressed me and why I feel that it's a very good thing for people to do is it really makes you aware of how young America is, because there are farms in Europe and towns that are, a couple thousand years old, structures still standing that have been in continuous use when America was a grassland inhabited by a very small population.
That's very true, and that's equally true in the Scandinavian countries building with logs, which I was really amazed to see. We were in Røros in Norway, and that's an old copper mining town, and there were log buildings there that were 500 years old and older, and still in very good shape. So they know something about building with logs that maybe we don't know yet.
Yeah, very interesting. I really like that, seeing what a difference that oldness made in the traditions that people carried on and so on. It was very interesting. I liked my time in Europe very much. And, of course, here in Alaska, we're almost in the opposite kind of place in terms of urban dwellings, not, of course, in terms of our rich the rich culture that exists in the bush, but in terms of our cities, they're very young, of course. So Fairbanks has really changed, I know, during your visit, during your life here.
Very much so.
It's amazing to think of how unsettled it really was just 30 years ago, which really...
Well, when we arrived, I think Fairbanks had 5,000 people total, and that was it. And Greater Fairbanks did not exist particularly. There were they were just starting 26 Mile, as Eielson was known then, and Ladd Field was the air base where Fort Wainwright is now. And other than that, Greater Fairbanks was an illusion.
That is one of the real pluses of this show for me, and that is that I am a real oral history buff or amateur fan of oral history. I think it's one of the best, most lively ways of getting information, and I've really had the great good fortune to talk to a lot of very interesting people on the show who have really been part of Alaska's history. I want to give a little plug. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a show of Alaskan women called Celebrating Alaska's Women, 1945 to 1965, and there are some wonderful pictures, one of which is Ginny digging an outhouse, I believe. But there are 45 photographs.
He always complains because whenever she had her picture taken, she always happened to be in a hole with a shovel.
Well, it's because she's probably spent a lot of time doing those wonderfully necessary projects.
She moves a lot of earth, I will say that.
That's right.
She's moving earth right now out in the garden.
Right. Well, that's a good place to be. But they're really wonderful, lively photographs of Alaskan women doing lots of non-traditional things, and it's in the Nolwenn Library and will be
right
there until May 31st. And so I encourage any of you who have a few minutes to stop by and see them. There are some very special photographs. So I thank you, Celia.
You're welcome.
Have a good summer. I hope your garden grows well.
If it ever gets in.
Yes. Well, it's a little early yet.
Okay,
a little early yet.
Take care.
I thank my audience very much for bearing with me this evening. This has been the Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. The executive producer is Carla Tonella, and I hope to talk to you next week. We're going to talk about gardening, my favorite subject. Have a nice week.
This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, and it's time for a Prairie Home Companion.
From Minnesota Public Radio.
Well, look who's coming through that door. I think we met somewhere before. Hello, love. Hello, love. Well, where in the world you've been so long? I missed you so since you've been gone. Hello, love. Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to a Prairie Home Companion. Coming to you live from the Orpheum Theater in downtown St. Paul, presented every Saturday night at this time by Minnesota Public Radio and by this public radio station. Oh, that music sounds so good. Mr. Willie Humphrey on the clarinet, Jeff Bull on the trumpet there with the Butch Thompson Trio, Peter Ostrushko, Mr. Greg Brown with us, Vern Sutton, Claudia Schmidt, and Mr. Howard Moore, the Bard of Cottonwood, Minnesota. Brought to you by your friends.